This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to everyone, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. This afternoon, we're going to be discussing epidemiology, at least in the sense of using epidemiology to introduce the term, to help you understand what epidemiology is, but more importantly, how epidemiology can lead us to better public health. And we're going to be doing that by looking at drowning in the state of Alaska and how epidemiology has helped us understand what is going on in the realm of drowning and what we can do to be better proactive at preventing these disorders. And I'll introduce this problem, and I'll introduce my guest shortly. But before I did, I thought I would continue to address the issue of the measles vaccine and autism in a little bit of a side swipe at this. The U.S. has just reported an increase in measles in this country, which leads to an 11-year high, although there were only 127 people. There were 127 people in 15 different states where the diagnosis of measles has been made. A lot of these are related to what appears to be a single outbreak of people traveling in Europe in particular, but people in multiple states have come down with measles. Almost all or a very large percentage were unimmunized. So what does that have to do with autism and measles? Well, first off, there's still, I think, among critically looked at data, some question as to whether or not autism has really increased in this country or anywhere. One reason is that it would appear, when you look at the data pretty closely, that autism appears to be increased only because of the definition of autism has been broadened considerably, and that coupled with an increased awareness. I think the data, the final consensus perhaps is out on that, but it may not be as clear as everyone thinks. And then there's been this concern that measles vaccine and or thimerosal, a mercury derivative in the vaccine, is related to that. And yet, there seems to be almost no significant evidence to suggest that. I won't go into the reasons why people started thinking about that in the first place, but it's an interesting trail to follow. If you ever were interested, you can put in your browser measles and Dr. Wakefield, W-A-K-E-F-I-E-L-D, and you'd probably get right back to where it all started. However, we should point out that since thimerosal has been removed from the vaccines in this country, there has been no change in the prevalence of autism. And it should be pointed out that in Japan, they never used any thimerosal in their vaccines, and there has been just the same amount of autism as a percentage of population as there was in the United States. So people have dropped their guard as to getting measles vaccines, partially, I would appear, from concerns about the vaccine. And as a consequence, we may be now seeing an increased incidence of measles. And we also, this is complicated by a group of families, young women and men who are having kids who have never seen measles and are not familiar with the consequences of measles. So just a little bit of information. I try to be as clear and as accurate as I can about this kind of information, but I'd keep your mind open about what you might be hearing about some of the downsides of vaccinations. Today we're going to be talking about drowning and epidemiology. As I said, my guest today is Jerry Dugan, who's joining us by telephone from the Flagstaff, Arizona part of the world, and we'll introduce him shortly. And in the studio with me is Dr. Jennifer Lincoln. She's deputy director of the Alaska Field Station of the NIOSH, National Institute in Occupational Safety Health, and she's the program manager for the Commercial Fishing Safety Research and Design Program. I failed to mention, Jerry, you're executive director of the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. Is that correct?
Right, and we're based in Sitka. You just happened to catch me on a flight out west.
Yeah. Right, I have a hard time finding you in Sitka. You move around a lot, it seems like. All right, so let's start, Jerry, with you, because I don't know. I know a little bit about epidemiology. I don't know a lot about the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. What are you doing down there? How long has it been in existence?
Well, AMSI, as we're better known as by our acronym, has been around since about the mid-1980s, and we're a nonprofit group that formed. It was kind of a grassroots effort on the part of a lot of people who worked for agencies and some people from the fishing industry, boating industry, who decided that something needed to be done. There were no good statewide or national standards on boating safety and cold water survival information. So it was decided that we should get together a curriculum with the best information, use the best experts we could find out there, and then do instructor training classes and train people in a curriculum that we developed with the best information we could get, and then have the rural ports in Alaska have their own home-based, port-based instructor, knowing how hard it is to get around and how expensive it is to get training, try to train people to have instructors in their own ports.
Okay. And did you say, I may not have been listening, how long you've been in existence?
It's since the mid-1980s, since about 1985, actually, so it's been about 23 years.
And how does the organization fund it?
We go for grants and for contracts, so we get contracts with different agencies, and we've gotten grants from a number of sources over the years to support and build this training infrastructure around Alaska as well as the rest of the U.S. The network has expanded to about all the other coasts now. About a third of the work we do actually is outside of Alaska now, but most of it's funded and for programs within Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lincoln, you work for NIOSH, and I've said it's the National Institute for Occupational Safety Health. Perhaps you could refine that or help us understand more what NIOSH is all about.
Sure. Well, NIOSH is part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we focus on our charge is to be proactive in preventing work-related illness, injury, disability, and death. And the office here in Anchorage was established in 1991 after Alaska was identified as the state with the highest work-related fatality rate of any state in the country. And so we started looking at high-risk occupations, and right after I started working in the commercial fishing industry and became a member of the AMSI board. And so the role that I play as a board member is not just focusing on the data for commercial fishermen, which is what I get paid to do by NIOSH. I also keep track of drownings for the entire state of Alaska.
Okay. And the Centers for Disease Control is a federal agency that does a lot of the same kinds of work you do, but they're really looking at disease surveillance, not necessarily work-related injuries, is it?
Well, within CDC, there is a center that has an injury center in it.
Okay.
So there are injury
right.
epidemiologists that look at recreational or home-related.
Bicycle injuries.
Sure.
That kind of thing. Okay.
And NIOSH specifically looks at work-related injuries and illnesses.
All right. As a business owner, I think everybody's heard also of OSHA.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between NIOSH and OSHA?
Sure. Many times when I introduce myself and say that I work for NIOSH, I say I know it rhymes with OSHA, but we're not the same. We're not from the same group. NIOSH and OSHA were created at the same time,
mm-hmm.
But we were purposefully put in two different parts of the government. OSHA is a regulatory agency. NIOSH is a research organization.
Okay, so they're interested in making sure people are following certain regulations and
right.
acting on that. You're trying to gather information on what can be done to help prevent things.
Sure.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
So, all right, I want to keep going. I definitely want to get to drowning, but I also want to use this program to discuss epidemiology and its strengths and weaknesses. So what does epidemiology mean?
Epidemiology is is the study of how disease or injury is distributed in a population. The other part of it is that we look at factors that influence or determine the distribution of the disease or injury within a population.
Okay. So it helps recognize how much, why, perhaps,
yeah.
Where.
How much,
certain-
why, what, what's associated, mm-hmm. why is some group, some portion of the group falling victim to this, but other parts aren't?
Mm-hmm. And that's been used in your job to look at all kinds of occupational jobs. You said when NIOSH mm-hmm. was established up here in 1991, we had the highest death and injury rate in commercial endeavors of any country or any state?
Any state. Mm-hmm. We had the highest work-related fatality rate of any state in the nation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we want to do today is see if that's made a difference, if the study of these injuries has made a problem. And I won't ask you yet what's happened on that, but I'll try to remember to come back to that.
Okay.
So injury epidemiology then is, as you said, it's just looking at the incidents and associated factors with injuries on the job. And we have to choose our words carefully. We often use the word cause, and there's a difference between association and cause and effect.
Right. Of course there is.
Which, tell me specifically how you think of what the difference is.
Many times in epidemiology, you don't know what came first. You don't know that one thing caused another. You mm-hmm. just know that there's an association that mm-hmm. perhaps both things were present.
Right.
With science, in order to prove causality, there are several things that have to happen. The experiment needs to be repeated. It has to be plausible. Proving causality is much more difficult than proving association.
Yeah, and I think the reason I'm trying to discuss this a little bit is there's going back to something that we talked about earlier. I talked about earlier today is the association between measles vaccine and autism. There is no evidence that there's a cause and effect. There seems to be very little now of concern about even an association. But an association, in a sense, we need to remember, just means something was at the scene of the accident. It doesn't mean that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a tendency in human nature to assume that when two things happen closely related, that there is a cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that if a person got a vaccine and something happened to them within some reasonable period of time, you jump to that conclusion. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on the measles, but one of the best answers to the question about concerns about measles vaccine I remember ever reading was from a woman who was a pediatrician whose daughter or son had autism. It's much more common in boys And she said, why would I want to think it was the measles vaccine? The day my child got the measles vaccine, he was licked by a dog, he picked up stuff on the floor and ate it, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, it's easy to make that association, but just because things are close together in time or space doesn't mean there's a cause and effect, and we have to be very careful about that. So mm-hmm. epidemiology allows us to look at that more closely, though,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it can rule out things. It can suddenly decide, well, there's a lot of people who got the vaccine who didn't get
sure
measles or so forth. So mm-hmm. there's both sides of that coin, which is important when thinking about whether diseases are caused by certain things. So it's a tool that's being used to look at both illness and injury. So tell us about the use in injuries, and particularly in Alaska.
Well, injury epidemiologists, when we conduct our investigations, the theoretical models that we use mirror that of infectious disease epidemiologists in that we look at the host or the person. In our case, we're interested in the person that was injured. And then we look at the agent that injures. So instead of looking at a microorganism, in my case, we look at either the vessel that the person was on or the water that they were near or something like that. And then and then also the vector in which the energy that caused the injury was transmitted. Mm-hmm. So, and we can also look at things, we can look at pre-events, factors that lead to an event that could cause an injury, and then we look at ways to decrease the severity of the injury. So, in commercial fishing, if somebody if the vessel sinks, we try to do things that would either prevent the vessel from sinking in the first place, or we focus on rescuing those people from the water. So, prevention can occur in mm-hmm. different phases of that event.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, and we're available by telephone if you'd like to ask questions about what you hear today or you have comments. 550-8433 is the local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also reach us by email at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Remember also this program rebroadcasts each Monday evening between 7 and 8, and that's a tape. So if you have questions or comments and you're listening between 3 and 4, or I'm sorry, 2 and 3, you can give us a call or contact us by email. After, if you're listening between 7 and 8, there's no direct communications with us at that time. So give us a call or email us if you have some questions about what you're hearing today. Jerry, it sounds like the way you introduced AMSI that it came about because of some of the data that had been accumulated epidemiologically.
Well, yeah, the catalyst that brought this group of agency people together was exactly what Dr. Lincoln talked about, which is the high rate of both recreational and commercial fishing fatalities, and which were in commercial fishing in the early days of AMSI in the mid-80s, it was over 40 a year, we think, 42, 43 a year, it looked like, just from newspaper clippings, and at least that many on the recreational side. So you're looking at just 80 or 90 deaths a year just from boating on both the recreational subsistence and commercial side. It was huge numbers, but the numbers weren't necessarily very good either. It was the agencies that did the counting used different methods. Some things fell between the cracks, and there was not very good data on causes. Quite often, we got the best data just from the newspaper clipping, and some agencies tracked this aspect of an incident, and others another aspect, and some maybe all they knew was somebody had died, and that was about it. So. But there was many things that were missing in the data that were going to be important if we're going to do interventions.
And prior to that time, no one, it doesn't sound like, was really gathering, accumulating the data or looking at it critically, much less acting on that.
Well, agencies were gathering the data. The Coast Guard was gathering data,
okay.
And the State Department of the Dr. Link would know better.
Probably AKPDS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. But things are still missing, and even today, sometimes there's problems with those agencies collecting data specific to this because they're collecting data on everything. And because they're casting such a big net out there, they're not always capturing the data that might be really helpful to your particular problem. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because you can count the number of drownings, but you don't know what were they doing, who was it, where were they, what time of year was it, what was the temperature of the water, were they wearing a life jacket? Had they had AMSI training, you know, all these things that when you focus on this particular injury, then you can start to collect that information to narrow in on what needs to happen to further mm-hmm. prevent these.
In infectious disease epidemiology, one of the first things I was trained to do when I first got trained in epidemiology was to make a disease definition. So if we were going to look at cough, we had to be sure we're talking about pertussis-related cough. So the case definition included, do they have evidence that they truly had pertussis? Because there's lots of reasons for cough, and so you're not comparing apples and oranges. It seems like in your job, it's not so hard to get a case definition, or am I overlooking or oversimplifying?
You're oversimplifying.
Okay.
When you look at, to prepare for this show, I went on to the CDC website and looked at the for Alaska, the leading causes of injury death.
Okay.
Well, the issue in particular with drowning is that some deaths are coded as drowning. Other deaths are coded as water transportation. or other transportation. So someone you know, on a snow machine that goes through the ice and drowns may actually be coded as an other transportation fatality versus okay. a drowning fatality.
Okay. And so when you're trying to gather that information and analyze it, you need to know as much about each individual case. And
yes.
then you also have to broaden how you're looking. You may go out into other categories of deaths or injuries and decide, well, that's not appropriate to be included in this bit of data.
Right. And then we have to be careful whenever we compare our numbers to, say, the drowning rates of other states, because we don't know. We have to make sure that we're comparing the same sort of incidents between the two areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay broad for just a second more. Tell us about injuries in Alaska now that are associated with work. What are the injuries and deaths? What are the important highlights that we might want to be aware of?
Sure. Injuries associated with death, or I mean with work?
Yeah.
The two leading types of injury fatalities that occur in Alaska are drowning due to the loss of a vessel, mm-hmm. and or a fall overboard, and the other one is aircraft crash. Now that's from 1990 through 2007. Arguably, looking at more recent years would help direct intervention efforts. And I don't know the most recent, say, 5-year time period. It would still be drowning, I assume, but I'm not sure what the second and third one would be.
And then there's different ways to look at this data, and so that may vary among ages.
Oh, absolutely. When you look at injury, death, in recreational, home related, occupational, in Alaska, injury is the third leading cause of death for all age groups. When you look at people aged 1 to 44, unintentional injuries are the leading cause of death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that you recently had a program on child safety
right.
seats.
Right.
When you look at the age breakdown of Alaskans, motor vehicle crashes are either the first or second type of fatal injury that occurs to children between 1 and 14, and also is unintentional motor vehicle crashes are the number one injury fatality for people that are 45 and older.
Mm-hmm. I know when I, as a pediatrician, when I'm dealing with families, I remind them that since I think it was in about the 80s is my recollection that injuries and accidents overtook infectious diseases and other illnesses as the leading cause of death in children. And I used the number up until you're about 30 or 35. And that's to point out that there has been success in public health endeavors, including immunizations, and quality of life has improved. And there will always be something that is the number one cause of problems. And we try to remind our parents now that seat belts, car seats, life jackets, helmets, and so forth are as important because of that, mm-hmm. that accidents and injuries have taken over.
If I can interject, I think that even led to a name change in CDC itself. Isn't that right, Jennifer? It was not just the Center for Disease Control anymore, but it's the Center for Disease Control and...
And prevention.
Yep.
And prevention, exactly, which is, just a direct result of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, when you look at drownings, is the information that's coming in helpful in when you start planning and educating people when you look at salt water or injuries related to workplace activities versus recreational kinds of injuries, which, again, could be salt water or fresh water? Does that information help you decide where to put some resources?
Well, absolutely. Our resources are finite, and we have to decide where to put them, where we'll get the most bang for the buck. And knowing that, the fatality, drowning rate in is highest probably in Western Alaska. In most years, we give Western Alaska a higher priority in our training and education efforts. We get numerous requests every year for education and training from our office, from those instructors that we've trained around the state, and we try to handle as many as we can. But if we get efforts and interest from Western Alaska, we tend to make that a higher priority because that's where the greatest need is. That's just one example of that.
And does the data that you have explain why Western Alaska, as opposed to Southeast Alaska, for example, would be a where the incidence of drownings is more an issue?
I think actually Southeast Alaska is right up there too. When
okay,
we look at the data.
So they're close. Okay.
I'm not going to say how close they are. Jennifer would have better information on that, but it's high. And I think what both of those areas include is a lot of time on the water by people, intensive use of the waterways in mm-hmm. open boats often, mm-hmm. which tend to be at a little higher risk, mm-hmm. and a lot of time on the water. And that's one of the things, again, we try to get from epidemiology is it's almost the holy grail is you can have a lot of people dying of a certain thing, like let's say drowning, but how much time are they really at risk? Because there's a big difference if people are only spending 10 hours a year in a boat and there's still a lot of people in that area drowning as opposed to people spending hundreds of hours a year in a boat and drowning, if you understand what I mean. So there's we'd like to also suss out to really get an idea of where the real risk are is how much time people are actually exposed to that risk.
So one of the suppositions or thoughts that kind of question information would bring me is it more likely that you are to succumb to a drowning if you spend a lot of time on the water and you're doing that a lot versus just occasionally because perhaps you're better experienced in one situation versus the other? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, there's many, many other factors in there, of course, also, like the size, the type of the season you operate in, the weather, uh-huh. the size, type of boat you're in, what type of personal protection you wear, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly you would expect, if everything else was the same, the longer you worked on bridges, the more opportunity there would be to have an accident working on the bridge.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, we have a caller. I'd like to take Gordon right now. Gordon, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thanks for putting me on. I just wanted to ask about drowning with children. And I know AMSI's been involved with the Kids Don't Float program and what an impact that's had in terms of drowning statistics in Alaska.
Do you hear that okay, Jerry?
Yeah, I just like the last part of that repeated about how has that affected the drowning statistics in Alaska?
Right, right, correct.
Another holy grail question, I think,
yeah.
and I might defer that one to Jennifer, who keeps track of those better.
Okay.
We've just finished looking at all drownings from 2000 to 2006, to see if the drowning rate in Alaska has decreased since the 1990s, and it has decreased. And I think that it's that some of the things that have been put into place over the last 10 years include the Kids Don't Float program, which is a personal flotation device loaner program. You see them all around the state now, where children can or parents can grab a PFD and provide it to their kids while they are on the water. Other programs that exist are float coat programs with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where they can offer float coats to the people that live in their village at a reduced price. And they also try to make these utility garments so that people would tend to wear them while they're hunting. I know some of them are camouflaged even. AMSI training has also impacted gotten into several different villages, several different coastal areas and interior areas to better prepare people when they are out playing and working and subsisting on the water. And then the other thing that has driven the drowning rate down has been the improvement in safety among the commercial fishing fleet.
Okay.
Yeah. And if I can just chip into what Gordon was saying too, just for clarification to give credit where credit's due, AMSI wrote the original curriculum for the Kids Don't Float program which goes along with it in the schools. But many of the harbor shelters that contain the PFDs are a result of efforts of the Coast Guard and the State Boating Office and things like that. We have this K through 12th grade curriculum, Surviving Outdoor Adventures, that's used extensively in the schools. Last time we looked, it was used in about half the school districts in the state, and there's activities, hands-on activities for K through 12th grade, and it's really hard to measure the effect of those because we often don't get the names of those children, and we don't do long-term tracking of those people. That would be a massive kind of surveillance project. And sometimes we can't get those names because of school districts now increasingly have more privacy concerns about giving anybody else names of people in programs like that. But overall, we feel there's been effect, and we get anecdotal stories of how that's helped out. One of which was just last year when I'm fishing the Little Rock in Southeast Alaska, and the skipper asked everybody on board, including his fifth grade son, to put on immersion suits in, just in case the boat was going to sink. And instead of it causing a panic, the fifth grader said to his dad very proudly, "Well, we just did that in school last week. I know how to do this. Watch me." Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would have been not a panic situation in that particular case. So, and I think both things come into play. It's important to look at the epidemiological information to see where that can lead you, but anecdotal information also gives you kind of illustrates or shines a flashlight on some of what the figures might mean.
Okay. Gordon, does that answer your questions?
Yes, it's very helpful. Only thing I want to add is I know AMSI did the funding for a lot of those Kids Don't Float stations. And, of course, the original sponsor of that was Bob Painter with the Kenai Safe Kids Coalition. It's now spread statewide. Hmm. But an important partner in that was AMSI's contribution and that partnership of getting those PFDs available throughout the state.
Yeah, I guess I'm naive also, although I ride my bike and walk around Winchester Lagoon and have noticed over the last 10 years that suddenly these flotation devices have shown up there. I didn't realize where they came from.
Yes, it's a homegrown project that really has been a real valuable partnership of using some of the licensing fees to get those flotations available to be sent out, and then different local communities putting them up. And there's, I think, over 500 sites at this point in time throughout the state.
I guess that's kind of a subtler way or a subtle way to try to avoid regulation and legislation.
I think legislation, and I hope Jennifer talks about a little bit about that, is an important part of health programming intervention. The requirement that people in boats who are 15 or under wear a PFD was a critical component in getting that enforcement.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to get into that because, and I'm just not aware because I'm not a boater of what the rules and regulations or legislation is, but having spent a lot of time in nonprofits trying to educate people, I've come to the conclusion it's much more cost-effective just to use the data to try to convince legislators that, hey, you know, we need seatbelts, we need car seats, we need
flotation. I think education, enforcement, and engineering are three basic E's in terms of we're all becoming safer.
Okay.
I think if I can follow up with what Gordon said, I think you hit a key point there. You can have legislation and you can have regulations, which people react differently to. But when you enable people to implement that regulation, it makes it so much more effective.
Yes.
So, for example, there's a state law that kids under 13 have to wear a life jacket. Well, great. But when you actually put them in the harbor and you have to walk by as you get onto the boat, there's your implementation. It's just easy to do now. Yeah. And that's I think, been one of the successes about the Kids Don't Float program. Kids Don't Float program around the state.
And to me, I'd also say that's a very creative use of all of our limited resources. And I think that's it's a wonderful example. So whoever came up with that.
Well, the person who came up with it was Bob Painter. To give him credit, who is the fire chief down in Homer.
Mm-hmm.
And he originally got it from the Harlem Hospital, who had the Kids Don't Fly project, which was keeping kids in the high rises from falling out of the windows, and came back here, saw a doll in the harbor, and said, "It's a shame kids don't float." And from that came up the whole project. So there is a person. This is one of the few times where we actually can trace back where things came from. And just wanted to put my own two cents in there, and I think it's a good program today.
Well, thanks very much.
Take care.
Have a good day.
Thanks, Gordon.
So, Jennifer, getting back to the epidemiology doesn't stop once you gather the information. You're trying to see if you can use that information to induce change and then whether or not that change is effective. And you're telling us now that despite the growth in the number of people that are probably on the water, there's evidence that the number of drownings, probably, I don't know if the absolute number, but certainly the percentage of the population is now...
The rate is decreasing.
Suggesting that like not proving cause and effect again, but making a very close association between what some efforts that are being made in saving lives.
It's going to be interesting to see. A few years ago, I remember, I think Jennifer remembers this, nationally that the drowning rate went down quite a bit, and it correlated with the last time that there was a spike in oil prices, so which implicated that people boated less maybe because there was fuel was more expensive. So it'll be interesting to see in this current surge if the same thing will happen.
Sure. And that's, from my old epidemiology training, that's a confounding variable. It's right. Does crime go up because the economy gets worse, or is it because we have more police officers on the beat? Those are difficult, but can be looked at. If you anticipate those kinds of issues, you can control for those. Is that right?
Certainly. You can collect information now so you can evaluate that hypothesis later. One thing that Gordon brought up, the three E's, and one of them being enforcement as far as regulations go, I think that another important aspect of public health is certainly to provide information for policy development. But it's also important to recognize that not all regulations are enforceable. And one of the things that I think that this, in particular, this drowning study does, it allows us to start looking at where can interventions be made. In particular, why don't adults wear PFDs? And, you know, next year we're going to throw a bunch of PFDs at adults and say, what do you like about this? What don't you like about this? And take that kind of information back to manufacturers to redesign some things and make things easier for people to wear. Don't get me wrong. I understand that regulations, you know, we need laws passed for people to wear seatbelts and laws passed for kids to wear PFDs, but there's more to it than just regulations.
Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guests today are Dr. Jennifer Lincoln from the NIOSH office here in Anchorage and Jerry Dugan from the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. And we're looking at epidemiology and using data accumulated about accidents and injuries, both recreational and workplace, and how that can help us improve outcomes both in the workplace and during recreation. So if you've got questions or comments about some of the information you hear today or just want to make some observations, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can reach us at line 1 at kska.org via email. What other important bits of information about drowning do we need to tease out? What's the difference between freshwater and saltwater, for example, and age groups and so forth? I'm kind of curious about that.
Is the question what do we need to or what would
no,
we what, like
what,
to?
What do we know?
What do we know?
We
do know that, as I said, the drowning rate has declined since the 1990s. The majority of drownings in our state occur among males. When you look at the drowning rate for children that are 0 to 9, the rate for girls and boys are about the same. But as the population gets older, if you start looking at the people older than 9, then you see that the drowning rate for males is much, much higher, indicating that maybe they're spending more time out doing the types of things. Maybe they're on the water more, as Jerry said.
But they're also, I'm going to guess, less likely to have a flotation device on. True. Do we not know that? Oh, Jennifer's saying we're not so sure. Jerry, you're saying we have the data, or you're pretty sure that's true.
By individual harbor surveys that have been done in Southeast Alaska, you can see that there's,
okay.
It's almost like a rite of passage. Now I'm an adult. I don't need to wear a life jacket anymore.
Right, right. Well, that's the way seatbelts used to be, and to some degree, unfortunately, still remain. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry. You talked about male, female, age differences. Saltwater, freshwater, commercial versus recreational.
I don't have the saltwater, freshwater information with me. About 25% of the drownings are work-related. And let's see, Alaska Natives have a higher fatality rate per capita than other groups of people. I don't have information on alcohol with me.
Yeah, that was one of the thoughts. Is a confounding variable is how often is alcohol related? Certainly, in driving accidents and deaths and fatalities involving cars, it's a huge issue. I'm guessing again that it probably has alcohol as a factor and probably a critically important factor.
I know that we did look at that in this recent analysis.
Mm-hmm. Does that it true both commercially as well as recreationally, or we don't know that for sure yet?
And commercially, when you look at commercial fishing fatalities, I have this paper in front of me here is looking at falls overboard in particular, and alcohol involvement was a circumstance, but it wasn't one of the leading circumstances of a fatal fall overboard.
What are the most important? Weather?
The most important are whether or not you are actually fishing your gear when the event occurs. If you're alone on deck, that has been associated with the higher number of fatal falls overboard and heavy weather.
Yeah, and so the working in the gear is that you get tangled in the gear or somehow incapacitated, knocked unconscious, knocked overboard, something like that.
Right. So to prevent falls overboard, you want to focus on preventing the person from ending up in the water in the first place, or you want to make sure that if they're in the water, they've got flotation, and there's a means for them to get back into the boat, particularly if they're fishing by themselves. And that actually applies to recreational boaters as well, or subsistence boaters.
I always like the question about misconceptions. Are there significant misconceptions about drownings? And I'm just going to throw open the whole word about drownings, not be very specific, and see what you guys say about that.
Jerry, you probably have more anecdotal stories than I do.
Boy, where to start? I just went to...
I float was maybe one of the first misconceptions.
Right. Yeah. I just went to a website, which will remain anonymous, on survival, and it had to do with drowning. And there was some information in that website that I thought was a little bit not correct, so I send it to Dr. Nimroff and Dr. Steinman, who are they've been studying drowning issues for decades, and they just sent me an email with just peppered with all the details that were wrong in the supposedly authoritative website. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions. Maybe the biggest one is it doesn't happen to me. It's the other guy's problem, and that especially is directed at youth people, young men especially, who spend a lot of time on the water and who are still in that invincible stage. And in fact, they are the highest risk people for drowning, as Jennifer mentioned, and yet they have the lowest awareness of the risk. So that's one overall big misconception, I think. Other misconceptions are about, that are kind of big ones are, if you fall in the water, you're going to drown. That's just, if you go in the water, you die. And that's been an age-old one, but that still exists in a lot of places. If you've got flotation on, you've actually got some survival time in the water.
Are you talking about cold water?
Is cold water.
Temperature have come into this issue? Yeah.
Right, and which in Alaska, that's all we have is cold water, basically.
Right.
But it's not something that you just fall in the water and you're necessarily going to drown anymore. That's more prevalent also in, I think, older people who have sometimes some industries, especially like commercial fishing, has long traditions and
that was a fatalistic attitude that fishermen had for a long time that's changed in the last 20 years, I think, now that they've seen so many people survive boat sinkings because of immersion suits and life rafts and emergency position indicating radio beacons. So I think some of those misconceptions are kind of cultural misconceptions, I think. The old thing of, well, you know, if the boat goes down, you're going to go down with it. You know, the sea giveth, the sea taketh. That has really changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And then just in terms of some specifics, I don't know if I've got the juices going, Jennifer, but I might throw it back to you for a minute.
Well, the one that I wrote down that you haven't mentioned is when your vessel sink, you're not sucked down with it. I think Jerry uses in his classes a great anecdote about the, was it the cook on the Titanic, I think?
Cook on the Titanic, yeah. The two risks with being on the boat too long are entanglement and entrapment, but it's not being sucked down by the boat. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you remember the movie Titanic, we might as well mention it. If you remember the boat going down, the hero and the heroine are talking to each other, and there's this white-clad figure next to it who takes a short glance at the heroine, and they just exchange glances, but they don't exchange any words. And then the boat goes down, and the story pretty much ends from there. Well, that man, that figure, is actually a historical figure. His name was Charles Dewing, and he was the chief cook on the Titanic. And in the book, A Night to Remember, which is the classic book on the Titanic, he quotes Charles Dewing in that book, and he says, "I was standing on the stern of the Titanic, and the stern dropped out from underneath me, and I stepped off the boat, and I didn't even get my head wet." Hmm. He floated away, which is just about as much as myth-breaking as you can get on that particular myth.
Okay.
Other myths, I think, are maybe taking your clothes off in the water, because clothes will weigh you down. In fact, in an emergency, especially in the first 5 minutes, that is so critical, especially in a cold water immersion, keeping clothing on can actually trap air and help keep you afloat while you regain your breathing. Mm-hmm. And so stripping yourself of clothing or taking clothing off and whipping them up through your head to fill them with air, to use it as a flotation aid, those are really warm water techniques. Not useful for cold water because the amount of energy you expend actually decreases your survival time.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that comes to mind is that I could swim to shore. I'm mm-hmm. not that far out. I could swim to shore. And that's something that I know that AMSI has stay rules that they mention during training, and one of them is stay with the boat.
Mm-hmm. And the reason to stay with the boat?
Bigger target. You've got something to keep yourself out of the water with. And for long-term survival in cold water, the more you can get yourself out of the water, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Commercially made recreational boats, I believe it's under 21 feet, are made to float upside down.
Okay.
That's a condition that they have to meet, a legal condition that they have to meet. So knowing that, if you know that, and you can get on top of it, you can get yourself out of the water. And that's exactly what happened to me many years ago in the early 80s. I actually was in a boat that flipped. It was a small 14-foot open skiff, and I ended up in the water. And I remember hearing that statistic, and I was wondering whether to swim to shore, which was about 300 yards away, or get on the boat. And I remember that the boat would be stable if I got on top of it, and I got on top of it, and it was. And then that gave me time to think. Kind of your inventory, part of your survival, and I realized the tide was coming in, and about 45 minutes later, I just stepped off the boat onto the beach. That 300-yard swim, I would probably not have survived. And in fact, the person on the beach was going to help, who saw this happen, was going to swim halfway out and meet me, which means that both of us would have probably drowned in that case. And,
this is moving faster than I even looked. I looked up at my watch or clock. We've got it less than 10 minutes. And another thought that comes to my mind is medical care has been looked at very critically, epidemiologically recently, is making mistakes, and we're using that information to try to improve things. But one of those which is always going to be an issue in the commercial realm, is this issue of sleep deprivation. And we didn't comment on that, but my thought with commercial fishers is what I know, have heard, and see is that that's got to be a big issue. Are there regulations regarding that? I'm guessing no. And how much of a factor is that, or we just don't know because that information is hard to get?
Well, maybe I'll lead off with that if it's okay.
Yeah.
On commercial vessels, not commercial fishing vessels, but on licensed vessels like ferries, cargo vessels, tugboats, there are mandated watch keeping hours, just like our pilots have.
Okay.
They're fairly the problem with them is they sound nice, but in fact, when you are in a tugboat that's got a fuel barge and you're coming into Hoonah, Alaska, and it's the middle of the night and it's your time to be off watch and supposedly resting, you're on deck because they need everybody on deck. So it's sometimes the practical platform of a boat just doesn't make it easy to follow those kinds of requirements. And of course, on commercial fishing boats, there most of the smaller ones, there are no guidelines or no regulations on that at all. Fishermen are pretty adept at maximizing the work schedule so they get the most efficiency, but sometimes the way fisheries are managed don't allow for that either. And that's where I think it's appropriate to hand it off to Jennifer.
So it would seem like one of the ways to approach this would be work through fisheries management, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just guessing it would be easier to sell this idea.
Well, safety is used to fisheries managers to argue for a change, and that has happened in a few fisheries in Alaska. The difficulty with measuring fatigue is there's a whole group of scientists that just work on that issue. But the notes that I was writing down as Jerry was talking is the way to address fatigue in the commercial fishing industry is through the management of the fisheries,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps trying to prevent the race to fish.
Mm-hmm.
With the idea that if you're not pressed to catch as much fish in a short amount of time, then perhaps you are resting more.
Another example of that on the East Coast was the way they regulated one fishery on the East Coast was to cut the number of crew from 6 to 5 people to reduce the effort. And then we had after that, a year after that, you had a spat of boats running into bridges because the crew was all sleep deprived because they just had to make up for the extra work effort with 5 people instead of 6.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's, again, an unintended consequence.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We got about 5 minutes, and I want to not forget my original thought is what is the evidence? What's happened to commercial deaths and injuries and on workplace deaths and injuries over the time since NIOSH has been here? Do we have evidence that in other aspects that we've been making an impact?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The work-related fatality rate has decreased since 1990. It has been, we've looked at both commercial fishermen, aviation deaths have decreased. We've looked at early on in our career. What we looked at, or in our tenure here, was helicopter logging fatalities. So it's these concentrated programs on high risk industries that have resulted in decreased fatalities. But also, there's been a change. I say that, and I need to give credit to the workers. Workers in these high-risk industries have also been more proactive in adopting safety as a, mantra, I guess, and have been receptive to ideas both by more regulations or by just changing their practices.
Jerry or Dr. Lincoln, I don't want to leave without talking about cold water and hypothermia or the effect of cold on drownings. We haven't spent a lot of time on that, and we talked about maybe some misconceptions about it. But how does that relate? It's my understanding is that there is a limited time and that cold does have an impact on your survivability. So let's define that as best as we understand it right now. How does that work as a factor? How much of a factor is it?
Yeah, I think that in the past there was confusion about the effects of hypothermia on the body as opposed to the effects of the cold response to the cold water, or sometimes called cold water shock, and they're two different things. People in the past confused those, I think, and what you would hear is, yeah, people would fall in the water and they would get hypothermic and they would drown. And in fact, hypothermia, if you define it as a lowering of the body's core temperature, it doesn't happen for 20 to 30 minutes after you're in the water usually, depending on what you're doing, what you're wearing, and many other factors like that. But the first initial thing that leads to drowning is that body's reaction to being in cold water, or cold response, the hyperventilation, the increase in blood pressure, the muscle cramps due to rapid breathing and flushing of carbon dioxide, and the disorientation you can get by getting cold water in the inner ear, and how those can affect you in the first 5 minutes. And of course, the first 5 minutes are the most critical time, I think, because that's when you're still responding both physically and psychologically to the situation that you're just in. And then 10 to 15 minutes later, you get swimming failure, again, not so much due to hypothermia, but due to the results of shunting of blood and to the body's core more and losing muscular control and fine motor skills, and then being uncoordinated and not being able to swim effectively any longer. And then later comes in your hypothermia and your unconsciousness, but by that point your body's already lost a lot of its ability to stay afloat, which stresses the importance of wearing some type of flotation device.
Okay. Well, we're down to close to a minute or so, and often in shows by making sure we leave our listeners with the most important bits of information. So what final comments would each of you like to leave with us today?
Wear your personal flotation device.
Wear your personal flotation device.
I know that's not
wear it
sexy,
again,
but
wear it again.
Yeah, wear it again.
So that's the most critical factor that you know of by looking at all the data that increases your likelihood of surviving out there on the water. Is that right?
And get your AMSI training.
Okay. Jerry, any comments from yourself?
Ditto. Wear some type of flotation. Most people who end up in the water don't know they're going to go in the water a second before it happens. And secondly, if you're going to drink, don't drink on the water. Those two combinations, drinking, being inebriated, and not wearing life jackets have been responsible. Those are two very common factors that you see. And I know just by looking at Sitka, over 90% of the drownings in the Sitka area that I know through my history of living there for 30 years, over 90% of them have both of those things. The victims have been males, young, not wearing life jackets, and have had alcohol on board.
All right. Thanks to both of you. And Jennifer, thanks specifically to helping us talk about epidemiology as well as drownings. And keep up the good work. We need public health people, both as far as disease as well as injury prevention. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next week, Line One is going to return, as you might expect. And our guest next week is Vince Bonham of the National Human Genome Research Institute. And we'll be discussing the importance of family health history. It's getting more important as we learn more and more about genomics and genetics. So why don't you tune into Your Health and learn more on Monday, July 28th at 2 p.m. We repeat the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.